Good afternoon, all. Rather than delay you from afternoon tea further, I'll make a start. My name's Jim Welsh. I'm your chair for the session. I'm mouthful of a title. I'm the Claims Reporting Insights and Analytics Manager at AMP Life. I'm also the chair of the Australasian Life Underwriting and Claims Association, ALUCA, to most. Today's session is Nudging Better Claims Outcomes, How Can Behavioural Economics Help? Our two presenters are Kranti Nekalapu. So Kranti is a senior data scientist within the analytics practice at Deloitte Australia with close to 7 years of experience. Prior to joining the Australian firm, he worked with the US and India Deloitte practices, leading teams and providing end-to-end solutions to complex business problems. He helped many organisations across multiple industries such as insurance, fraud detection, retail, C&IP and public sector uncover insights about their customers using data-driven analytics. Kranti has published numerous publications and is a regular speaker in various analytics forums talking about artificial intelligence, deep learning and behavioural science. Basim Morrison. Basim is a data analytics actuary at Deloitte Australia with a focus on enabling businesses to use analytics to realise the power of data. Prior to that, he worked in London as an independent risk analytics consultant to some of the largest European, Asian and Australasian financial institutions, as well as holding a management position with Deloitte UK. His experience spans analytics, general insurance, counterparty credit risk modelling, derivatives pricing and futures trading. Outside of work, he enjoys playing, watching and talking about soccer, so we can talk about Wales' unsuccessful World Cup campaign afterwards.
Thank you, Jim, for the introductions. Very happy to be here. Today we're going to talk about applications of behavioral economics. There are already a couple of sessions on behavioral science, so you might be wondering what this session is about. Analytics and data science are definitely two buzzwords in the actuarial community these days, and these are also, the themes in different forums. And we being active in the analytics space and me being a data scientist, we cannot really not talk about analytics. So in this session, we're going to talk about how analytics and behavioral science can be combined to get better outcomes. Before I dive into any content, just want to do a quick pulse check. How many of you work in the field of analytics and data science? Just by raise of hands. Great. How many of you have used behavioral science in your work? Wonderful. That's even more. Great. So here's what we have today. We'll talk a little about analytics, mostly around predictive modeling. We'll then talk about nudge theory. You've already heard about this in some sessions before. It doesn't matter how advanced the analytics solutions are, how good the algorithms are. They're only as good as the implementation strategy. This is often termed as the last mile problem, right? So you never complete the race unless you finish the last mile. And we're going to show how behavioral science can help us sprint that last mile. And we're not just going to talk about the last mile, we'll talk about the entire race as well. So we'll talk about the intersection of analytics and behavioral science. We'll also present you with a case study where predictive modeling and behavioral science were used together to help unemployed people return to work. This was a case study from work we did in New Mexico. And then we'll talk about applications and return to work, claims outcomes. All right, so types of analytics. We can imagine something like a pyramid. So this is the hindsight, insight, and foresight thing we see there. At the bottom of the pyramid, we have descriptive analytics, which is basically summarizing and creating metrics and KPIs and coming up with some insights from our historical book. Then we have prescriptive analytics, or some people also call it detective analytics. So this is the insights piece. Then we have predictive analytics, where we forecast or predict the future. In this presentation, we mostly focus on predictive analytics, although we'll see applications of all three across the life cycle of a claim. For example, if you look at the life cycle of a workers' compensation claim, starting when a claim is notified, we can have predictive models using information available at the first notice of loss to triage claims into different risk groups and based on how complex they are or how severe the claim is going to be, probably going to be. So if the claim is going to be is not going to be complex at all, then we could send it through straight through processing. If it is a complex claim, then we could have some senior case managers tend to that and, you know, spend more time reviewing the claim and settling it. Better case estimation can help us set aside more accurate reserves. If there's any escalation, we could use predictive models to identify fraud or identify claims with which are above certain threshold and report them to, you know, the investigations unit. Predictive models can also help us in litigation management, coming up with the right litigation strategy or to even predict whether a claim would go through litigation or not, even before it goes through it. And obviously, we can assess the performance of claims managers. So this is more descriptive, understanding how claims managers performed on different types of claims. And this can help us determine who the best claim manager would be given the characteristics of a particular claim. Then we have return to work. So here, predictive models can help us classify claims into different profiles or claimants into different profiles. And we can understand about the claimant's properties, and this can really help us come up with the right return-to-work strategies. So today we're going to focus on this, the return-to-work part, and we'll talk about how behavioral economics can be leveraged here to help design better return-to-work strategies. With that, I'll hand it over to my colleague Basim to talk about behavioral science.
Thanks, Kranthi. So as Kranthi mentioned, we believe that advanced analytics and behavioral science are two sides of one coin. Now, to talk about the behavioral science side of things, as we all know, human behavior is an astonishingly complex subject matter. A lot of the data being collected these days is often trying to capture one aspect of human behavior. A lot of the predictive models being built these days are trying to predict some sort of human behavior as well. So there's a huge focus, and there should be a huge focus, on the human behavior side of modeling rather than just building models for the sake of models. We've heard a lot today about mental health injuries, but I think even with physical injuries, there's always a psychological aspect to it. So you can never ignore that psychology, the behavior of the claimant. That's where behavioral science comes in, the study of human behavior. And it's very useful. In particular, nudge theory. You may have heard of nudge theory, and there's a lot of focus in the media over the last few weeks because the father of nudge theory, Richard Thaler, won the Nobel Prize a few weeks ago for his work in this. I'm going to use a line from a movie, see if you can tell which movie this is. "He's me planting an idea in your head. I tell you, don't think about elephants. What are you thinking about?" I've tried to nudge you there to think about a specific subject. Nudge theory, as I mentioned, was started by Richard Thaler. He's a behavioral economist and a professor in the University of Chicago. He wrote a very famous book called Nudge back in 2008. Now, nudge theory argues that if I want to influence your behavior or change your behavior, instead of me legislating something or enforcing a law on you, if I just gently, indirectly suggest something, that could be more powerful than a hard law. If I use positive reinforcement, as we heard earlier this morning, the carrot, that could be more powerful than the stick. So that's basically the idea behind nudge theory. Now, here are some examples. Basically, the idea with nudge theory is that you use certain human psychological tendencies to help people make better decisions. So, for example, us human beings, we dislike change, right? We just have a natural tendency to dislike change. So what happens if I set the optimal decision as the default? Example, in the office, I set double-sided printing as the default option. We dislike change, you'll notice a huge reduction in paper. Another example, us human beings, we have a tendency to conform to social norms. So if I tell you everybody else is doing it, will that affect whether you do it or not. Another thing about us human beings is that we dislike being last. When we're compared to our peers, we dislike coming in last place. They ran some research around people queuing, in any queue, in a retail store. If you're in a queue and you're last in that queue, your level of annoyance is very, very high. If one person comes and stands behind you, your annoyance drops a little. Even though the waiting time hasn't changed, you're still in the same position, but the fact that you're not last makes you feel better about yourself. So what happens if I compare you to your peers and tell you that your driving behavior is in the worst percentile of your peers? Or if I compare your energy usage at home and I tell you that you are the last out of all your neighbors when it comes to consuming energy, will that impact your behavior? All these are examples of some nudges. As I said, we're not legislating anything. There's no law. There's no rule. It's just an indirect suggestion that's usually more powerful than a law. Last example. Imagine you walk into a store to buy a particular product, a supermarket, and on top of that product that you're going to buy, you see a big sign saying maximum 6 per customer. You may think, well, instead of buying one, maybe I'll buy two then. That's called anchoring. I've just anchored you to a certain number, and you'll naturally tend towards that number. So there's some examples of some nudges. I'm going to show you some actual nudges that you may have seen before. They're quite famous, but I thought it'd be quite fun to show you. Here's an example of a nudge. This was used in Hamburg. Hamburg were bidding for the 2024 Olympics. This is in the underground in Hamburg. Now, you have to admit that the stairs never looked so attractive, and the escalator never looked so dull. And I bet if they measured the speed that people went up the stairs, it would probably increase as well because of that nudge. Here's another very sophisticated nudge that actually was thought of by an economist who worked at Schiphol Airport, International Airport in Amsterdam. In Amsterdam, they had a problem with... I'll show you the nudge. They had a problem with spillages in the urinals. So what this genius thought of is, if I just get a sticker that looks like a fly or an insect and I stick it in the urinal, I bet I'll nudge the users to aim. And that happened. Apparently, they reduced spillages by 80%. Don't ask me how they measured that, but that's the statistic. So as it turns out, give men a target and they can't help aim at it. That's the learning from that. This all started back in 2012. The British government, surprisingly, governments were actually one of the first adopters of nudge theory. So the British government has a behavioural insights unit, so do other governments these days. But back in 2012, the UK government tried an experiment. In the UK, if you are late paying your taxes, the government will send you a reminder letter reminding you to pay your taxes. So what they thought is, let's try a nudge. So they took a control group, and for a randomly selected group, they just added one letter, one sentence to the letter. All they added was this: 9 out of 10 people in your town, whatever that town is by name, pay their taxes on time. What they found is that because of that one sentence in that group, tax payments went up by 23%. They saved the government £190 million. They call this the £190 million sentence. So just by changing the words you use and the interaction you have with your customers, you could make millions if you're clever about the way you do it. As I mentioned, these days the US government uses behavioural nudges quite heavily. The New South Wales government as well has a behavioural insights unit since 2012, and they're working on such things as domestic violence and child support and important issues like that. Now, when your ultimate goal is behaviour change, when you combine predictive analytics with behavioural nudges, the sum of the two are greater than the sum of the parts. A good example of this is in 2012, in the US presidential election. If you remember, it was Obama running against Romney. They called that the first big data election. What happened was that both Romney and Obama employed teams of data scientists charged with building predictive models to segment the population. So they effectively segmented the population in three buckets. One bucket are the hardcore Obama supporters, hardcore Romney supporters. The bucket of interest was the one in the middle, those most likely to be swayed. And they focused their efforts on that bucket. How did they do it? So that was the analytics side. The analytics predicted the bucket that you should target your efforts on, rather than just randomly going out and the volunteers going out to visit people and knocking on random doors. They targeted who they were going to visit, that group that could be easily influenced. Now, what they did once they identified that segment, they applied nudges. Example, so the case workers, so the campaign workers would go, knock on their doors, and they would ask them to sign commitment cards that they will vote for Obama. The card has a picture of Obama on it, and they sign their name saying they commit to voting to Obama. Because us human beings, if we commit to something, we are more likely to follow through with it. So that was one nudge they used. Volunteers also asked people to articulate exactly what they're going to do on voting day, how they're going to get to the polls, where are they going to vote. Because if you formulate a plan in your mind, a detailed plan, again, you're more likely to follow through with it. In some instances, they told them that their neighbours are all voting for Obama as well, again, for the social norms nudge. The idea is that you can get considerably more benefit and target your resources, your limited resources, a lot more effectively if you combine predictive analytics to segment your population, understand which segments to nudge, and then apply tailor-made nudges to the segments to have the most impact. So not only are you using analytics to predict an outcome, but you're actually influencing the outcome through behavioural science. Okay, so a real case study, because obviously it's easy to talk. Talk is cheap. Let's talk about an actual project that we worked on and how these two were combined. So this project, as Kranthi briefly mentioned, was in the state of New Mexico in the U.S. What happened was that in the U.S., they say around more than $4 billion worth of unemployment benefits are paid to people who don't deserve those benefits. You could call them fraudulent, mostly soft fraud. That's one out of every $8 is being paid to someone who shouldn't be getting paid those benefits. The way it works in the US is that when you lose your job, initially you go online, everything's done online, you go online, you report that you've lost your job, and then every week you log back on and you report your progress throughout the week. Have you looked for jobs? Have you earned any money? And everything's done electronically, and the unemployment benefit gets sent straight to your bank account. So obviously a lot of scope for fraud and inaccurate information being given. So Deloitte worked with the Department of Workforce Solutions in New Mexico to identify the main areas of the application process where fraud was occurring. And here were the areas. So, number one, during the initial application process, you are asked for the reason you've lost your job, whether you were laid off, be made redundant, or you were fired. If you choose fired, you get less benefits than if you were laid off. So that was a potential area for inaccurate information to be given. Secondly, the reporting of weekly earnings. Every week you log on, as I mentioned, and they ask you, have you earned any money this week? If you say, yes, I have earned money, they deduct the money you've earned from your benefits. So obviously it's in your interest to say, I haven't earned anything, to maximise your benefits. So that was another area of potential fraud. The last area was the work search requirements. So every week you are supposed to commit to 2 work search activities, whether that's applying for jobs, making phone calls, going to an interview, to be eligible for the benefits. So they were the 3 areas where fraud was happening the most. So traditionally what you would do is that you would look at these areas and ramp up resources to go investigate these fraudulent claimants. But maybe you can be a bit more clever about the way it works by applying nudge theory. So again, as I mentioned, analytics with behavioural science work very well together. Use analytics to identify potential fraudulent claimants. So the way we did it was that in real time, as the applicant is online making the application, in real time predictive models are being run in the background to give a probability of fraud to this particular claimant. If the probability was high, depending on where in the application process is happening, out of the 3 areas, a nudge was applied. So let me talk you through it in practical terms rather than just theory. So let's just say I've lost my job and I go online to apply for unemployment benefits. First thing I get asked is, why did you lose your job? Were you laid off or terminated? So I think to myself, oh, look, I was fired, but to be honest, it was very unfair. You know, and that boss hated me from day one anyway, so it was so unfair. So I'm just going to say laid off. So I choose laid off. In the background, the analytics picks me up as potential, high potential for fraud, high propensity to fraud. All of a sudden, a pop-up comes on the screen. This is where the nudge comes in, with a letter addressed to my employer with my name, asking if Bassem was actually laid off and asking him to confirm that I was laid off and sign and return it back to the Department of Workforce Solutions. That we found was quite a powerful nudge to nudge people to go back and choose the honest answer. Fine. I'm now having unemployment, receiving unemployment benefits. Week on week, I'm logging on to report my weekly earnings and my activity. One week I log on and it asks me, have you earned any income the last week? So I think to myself, yeah, well, I did a bit of part-time work, but to be honest, it was nothing. Like, it was just pocket money. It's not even worth reporting that. So I just choose no income this week. All of a sudden, a pop-up comes on the screen saying to me, a pop-up, by the way, that I haven't seen any other week, just this week, because I've been flagged by the predictive models that I am high propensity fraud this week. A pop-up comes on screen saying to me, 99 out of 100 people in your town, whatever that town is, report the earnings accurately. Please report your earnings accurately. Again, we found that actually to be one of the most powerful nudges. It seems that us humans have a huge tendency to conform to social norms. So that was one of the best nudges. Another nudge we applied is, if you are flagged as potential fraud, you get extra questions popping up, asking for more detail that you haven't seen any other week. Another nudge that was applied for this particular stage, reporting weekly earnings, is that you were asked, again, never before were you asked to put your initials at the bottom of the screen to sign your declaration. Again, they were very powerful nudges. For the work search criteria, we ask claimants to commit to a specific job search goal. So over the next week, I will make 3 phone calls, I will apply for 4 jobs, specific, quantifiable plan to find work. And we found that to be a very, very effective nudge. So the results of this. So after applying predictive analytics in real time and behavioral nudges in real time, claimants were twice as likely to report new earnings, half as likely to commit fraud, and 20% more likely to find work over the next few months. That saved the Department of Workforce Solutions in New Mexico about $2.3 million a year. Again, by combining predictive analytics with behavioral science and making just some fine tweaks to the experience of the customer, you could have a huge impact. Okay, so applications in claims outcomes. I'm not going to give you all the answers today. I guess what we're trying to do today is to get us to think about, I've given you a case study now, not really in insurance, related to unemployment benefits. Can this be applied in insurance? Can it be applied to injury management? I strongly believe that it can. I think there's a lot of applications between what we just discussed and what we could do with injury management. So, just a few ideas. And to be honest, this isn't rocket science. I'm sure, you know, we've all come across these before, but let's think about it in this light, in terms of applying predictive analytics to segment your population more accurately and then apply tailor-made nudges. So, a few tips. Nudge early. As we've heard, the longer things take, the less likely you are to return to work. So early contact with the claimant to promote a focus on return to work right from the outset is quite powerful. You can also anchor. So remember when I spoke about anchoring. Anchor staff, the case managers, to reach out early to the claimant. Rather than within 20 days, anchor it, say, to within the first 2 days, within the first 3 days. You've just anchored it to be a lot more sooner. Also, reach out to the doctors early, potentially, to gain valuable medical feedback from them. and also to outline to them the support that's available for the claimant. So I think nudging early is quite important. Secondly, keep it simple. As we heard, I think it was the last presentation, too much legislation and too much legal talk, it doesn't help. It causes disengagement. If you want the claimant to be really engaged with the whole return to work process, keep it simple. Keep the key messages prominent. Make it very clear what the claimant needs to do, and it will be easier for them to understand their responsibility, and it will increase their likelihood of actually engaging in the process. Focus on recovery. This is very, very powerful. Focus on recovery rather than on the injury. Change the mindset of the claimant. Rather than focusing on my injury and my problem, focus on recovering. As I said, with all physical injuries, there's a huge psychological, mental component to it. We shouldn't discount the mental when there's a physical injury. The two go hand in hand. So you could nudge both the claimant and the employer to focus on recovery and return to work. I was thinking in preparing this presentation of looking at the whole ecosystem when it comes to injuries, whether it's the injured person, the employer, the medical providers, that the whole ecosystem, and you can identify nudges all over the whole ecosystem for different parties involved. But again, using predictive analytics to segment the population more accurately, you can apply tailor-made nudges to each segment. So when it comes to focusing on recovery, I know one insurer, for example, who replaced their injury management plan to a return-to-work plan. The focus is not on the injury anymore, the focus is on the return-to-work. Again, you can anchor the claimant. The first correspondence you send to them, you could say to them, most people with your injury recover in 3 weeks. That's it, you've anchored them. They're expecting to be out for a few months. So as I mentioned, anchor expectations. Make it personal. This is very, very important, actually. As I mentioned in the New Mexico example, when you see a letter addressed to your employer by name and mentioning your name, that's very powerful than just a generic letter. So try to mention their name as much as possible to promote that ownership, that sense of ownership. For example, you could call it, instead of this is your recovery plan, call it Bassam's recovery plan. The more they see their name, the more ownership they will feel. And finally, commitment. As I mentioned in your New Mexico example, if we commit to a plan, we're more likely to follow through with it. So have personalized goals and plans that they've committed to. Make sure they write them down, sign their name, again, for the sense of ownership, and potentially even share that recovery plan with others to promote accountability. So they're just some thoughts. As I said, I'm not going to give all the answers, but just things to trigger our thinking. By combining predictive analytics and behavioral science and making some minor tweaks to the experience of the customer, I believe that we'll have significant results. I'll pass it back to Kranthi just to finish up. Thank you.
Thank you, Bassam. Now, combining everything, we talked about how predictive models and behavioral science were combined to get better benefits. So this is a behavioral science-led analytical approach. So we have data, we gather data, we study, we come up with some insights, and then we use machine learning algorithms to predict. And based on the outcomes we get from these predictive models, we can design customized nudges for claimants. And these nudges can be implemented in a randomized controlled trial scenario. I'll talk about RCT in a bit. Then these nudges, the performance of these nudges can further be monitored. And we can quantify the impact of these nudges. So the test, learn, and adapt approach, this is very popular in the actuarial community with the name actuarial control cycle. Some people also call it A-B testing. Different names, but philosophy is the same. We basically divide the population into different groups randomly. We keep one group as a control segment. This is a group which will not be exposed to any treatments. Then we have different other groups which will be exposed to different treatments, in this case nudges. And sometimes these subjects could be exposed to a single nudge, and in some cases, it could be a combination of nudges. And we measure the performance of this over a period of time. We compare the control group with the treatment groups. And by taking into account the bias that could creep in, whatever difference we notice between the control and the treatment groups, we attribute that difference to the nudge applied on that group. right? So quantification is extremely important because the order in which the nudges were applied is also going to be important. If you have two nudges applied on the same individual or the same subject, the order in which the nudges are applied could have different result. Now, that's why understanding how the experiment needs to be designed and also deep understanding of statistical inference would be very important when we come up with, when we measure the impact of these treatments. So a few tips on what we need to keep in mind when we implement these nudges. So this is a framework our friends at the Behavioral Insights Unit came up with from the UK. Very, very popular, the Mindspace approach. This is one of the most downloaded reports on their website as well. I'm not going to go through all the examples here, but each letter stands for a different word. For example, it's important who communicates the information. Is it a computer-generated email, or is it a person speaking and explaining about returning to work or about the about injury management? Incentives. I find this quite funny because when humans are told that they would get some profit if they do a certain thing, as opposed to when they see loss when they do not do a certain thing, they seem to respond to the latter. So loss is a more imposing outcome than profit. Similarly, conforming to social norms, Bassam already talked about that. The power of defaults, needless to talk about power of defaults. In many countries, organ donation is really picked up just because the default option is you're automatically enrolled into organ donation rather than someone manually having to do that. Salience or attention is often drawn to what's novel. So telling somebody that this is a custom approach designed exclusively for them because they're unique and different from other people, that's going to have a stronger impact than telling them that this is a general plan, so you have to follow this plan. Priming or actions are often influenced by our subconscious cues and our emotional associations or commitments, ego. So these are some common things that we normally go through when we have to apply some nudges. Now, sorry. Just before I wrap it up, a quick summary. So what we're primarily advocating here is how predictive modeling and behavioral science can be combined to get better outcomes. So we can build predictive models to identify profiles of customers, identify the properties of different profiles, come up with customized nudges for them, implement those nudges in a controlled environment, and monitor the impact of those nudges. And, of course, learn from this and improvise what we are doing. A couple of parting thoughts. We always need to be aware of bias. Bias can always creep in. This is one of my favorite examples. Many retail stores perform this market basket analysis to see which products are often purchased together. And a common example would be chips and drinks are often purchased together. Now, if they decide to have an offer on this by combining these two and giving a discount if they buy both the products, and they want to see whether the sales would increase or not. Now, if they implement this right before, say, Soccer World Cup finals, then whatever increase in sales they see, that's probably not because of the offer, because there's bias created by soccer finals. So understanding whether there's bias involved or not is really important. And like Richard Taylor often says, nudge for good. Do not use nudges for personal benefits. Nudge for good, and that's what we also advocate. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, guys. If you will indulge me, I'll actually give you an example from life insurance, my field, where these have come together. So if you remember where I work, I'm not going to tell you now, so you have to guess. We had a joint actuarial claims investigation into our death experience. We actually then started looking at our terminal illness claims experience, and we looked at our forms for terminal illness assessment, and we reviewed people that we paid claims to for terminal illness. The definition is that you have to be certified, or the doctors say that you will pass away within 12 months. We Googled about 3 years worth of people. We found that the 15% of people were surviving past the year, which is a good outcome for them, but they are very, very sick people. We looked at the form, and the form had a very negative nudge. There's a big form there for the doctor to fill out with a box that said, will this person survive less than 12 months? If so, how many months will they survive? We'd find lots of 11s and lots of 10s. We changed that form to a positive nudge, positive anchor. We removed that box and said, in your experience of people who present with the same symptoms and prognosis, what is the average life expectancy? And we then researched that, and we found the only 4% of people had survived past 12 months. So it's a very sad story, but it just shows that you can actually increase the accuracy of the evidence that you're collecting to assess claims, and actually get much better information that's more nuanced, just by pulling some very simple levers. My question to you to start off with, and please ask a question using the microphone, is who's adopting this approach in our various industries, or who do you see as leading the way in other industries across Australia in using nudge theory?
I think from experience, unfortunately, not as many organisations are using this as they should be. As I mentioned, I think the leaders in this field would be the governments. So as I mentioned, the US government, the UK are quite advanced, and the Australian government as well is really getting into it. I know some insurers have dabbled in this, but again, I think there was a session on earlier where someone asked, why aren't people adopting this? What are the hurdles? And I think maybe the hurdles could be, again, it's a psychological thing, because we are actuaries, we are insurance people, we're used to the numbers and the hard facts. This seems a bit fluffy to us. It's hard to quantify, so that could be a potential hurdle. But I just think once an insurer takes this seriously, the rest will have to follow, because they'll be at a disadvantage if they don't.
Do we have any other questions? Can you use the microphone, please, Rob? Thanks.
Nudge theory has undoubted validity, and the intersection between predictive analytics and nudge theory is a very fruitful direction. But responding to the last question, we've spent a lot of time over the last 2 days talking about the provision of services on a very individualized level. Well, predictive analytics work with populations. Nudge theory works with populations. And so I'm wondering, is there something I'm not understanding that would allow you to take this approach, which is great at an epidemiological level, and make it very specific to a particular recovering people and particular programs in some of the work covers and so on?
Definitely. Many examples we saw are generally on the population, but what we are advocating here is that when we study the properties of different profiles, each claimant is unique. In the sense, predictive models can help us provide those reasoned messages why a claim is going to be severe. So if we take example of a workers' compensation claim, the models will tell us how long the person is likely going to be out of work. And what could be the reasons for that? Is it because the last time he got injured, so he went through a mental condition, and now it's the same injury, so this is probably also going to take a lot of time. So the models will give us such insights, and these insights are highly useful for case managers when they come up with these customized nudges. So we started talking to people who are actively involved in workers' compensation, and they see a lot of applications in this. And we started to also see how predictive models can be used to come up with like personalized nudges at an individual level.
I think we've got time for one more.
Great. Elaine Grace, the Actuaries Institute. I loved your last comment around, nudge for good, and I think it's a really important issue. One of the things I think we're seeing more around is, in some ways, you know, with data analytics, there's a potential to discriminate a lot. And obviously, over the last few days, you know, this thing around treating people like humans. I guess I see the potential for this as well. If we group people together and go, they're the group that are more likely to have fraudulent claims or whatever, we need to be able to make sure that we pass that front of newspaper test. Is that legitimate? Are we reinforcing past biases? And I guess I just, you know, I like that comment, and I think it's a really important one, that when you do this analysis, you think around Discrimination Act, you know, appropriateness, all of that kind of thing.
Definitely, I agree 100%. And actually, on that point, what I wanted to mention as well is that the beautiful thing about nudges is that if the model identifies someone as high propensity of fraud, you don't arrest them, you don't cut their benefits off them, all you do is you just nudge. So you haven't discriminated as such, and that there's no, you haven't, you know, discriminated against this person, you just nudge them. And even if that person is not fraudulent, the nudge won't hurt, if you know what I'm trying to say. So that's the beautiful thing about nudges, is that it's a gentle nudge. It's always a free choice of the claimant to choose. You haven't restricted their choice. It's just a simple nudge. And yeah, definitely. Thanks.
Just while I work my way back up there, one more example. We looked at underwriting, probably not applicable for a lot of people here. 15% of people in the Australian population smoke. In the underwriting population, 13% they smoke. The question used to be, do you smoke, yes or no? We changed it to yes, no, socially. Found that 1.5% of people smoke socially. How many do you smoke? One bloke smoked 40 a week. He was a really bloody social person. So just got to change the questions. Anyway, just want to thank you guys, Cranthy and Basim. Thank you very much.